Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
To those who missed the eyeshadow twilight, to those who watched fog gather in the valley below, to those who caught the magnolia scent from beyond the wall, come now to twilight fog and blossom in the moon underwater. Vespers, the matins, and all in between. It's the moon underwater here. I'm John Robbins, your, I'm gonna say mystical landlord of a mystical pub. And in this mystical pub, this pub of the mind, this pub of the soul, the pub that knows desire's reach, we invite guests to select their perfect pub lineup. And with me to assist, and he's contorted himself into all manner of different shapes in order to find a memory that was left hovering beneath one of the pews. I think he's just about got it now. It's the lovely Robin Allender. Hello, Robin.
Hello, John. Yes, I was very flat, like flat Stanley. I don't know if you ever...
You were?
Yeah. I got through the floorboards, found the memory... which was coloured like a sort of one of those marbles.
Yes.
It might have been it could have been a marble, actually.
Oh, was it a marble?
Yeah, it might have been a marble. But then I kind of unflattened myself, became my usual sphere, and, just back to business, really.
Yeah, and how are you finding the moon underwater tonight? How did it reveal itself to you in the, I'm going to say, half dusk?
Well, the half dusk, yeah, I sort of was walking down the street. I turned around a corner and kept turning round the corner. I sort of didn't stop turning round the corner, and the pub was sort of perpetually in the distance there.
Oh, great. I love it when it's perpetually in the distance there.
Yeah. I was sort of dwelling on the threshold. I was dwelling on the threshold.
Oh, mate. Dweller on the threshold.
Dweller on the threshold.
Did my ears deceive me? Is that the sound of can and hand?
It's the sound of can and hand, but it's only one of my fellow Heineken zeros.
Yes, and you brought that in with you to the moon underwater, because I don't know why you did, because we've got it here on draft.
I know. I just like to walk around with a big bag of cans.
Yeah, it is a nice feeling, especially when you're on the bus.
You walk down the road with a big bag of cans, that's amore.
That is amore indeed. Yeah. And do you like some of the new, we've got, I don't know where they came from, they just sort of became themselves, some of the new mirrors that we've got behind the bar.
Yeah, they're lovely.
With various sort of, is it gilt if it's not, what's it called if it's not gold? Is it just not gilt, is it? Gilding?
Like gold paint style.
Yeah, but it's not gold. It's sort of regular colours from the spectra.
Okay. And then very nice, the sort of stained glass mirrors, which I've never seen before.
Yeah, and spelling out some of the sort of well, patrons' names of the Moon Underwater, but also some old company names.
Is this company's house?
No. Well, maybe it is. Maybe it's...
Company's mirror.
Maybe this is company's house's mirror. But there's Wainwright Thingtons over there.
What, Wainwright Thingtons?
Wainwright Thingtons.
Oh, nice.
I think they used to make soles for shoes.
Yeah.
And there's... there's... Portescue's tonic wine.
Oh, yes. Victorian era tonic.
Wine. Tonic wine, yeah. Portescue's tonic wine.
Yeah.
And Savile Row, brackets, not the street that sells suits. Must be just another Savile Row.
Another Savile Row, okay.
Maybe it's specialised in sausage rolls or pastry or that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And that's it.
And
those are the three companies.
Bit odd.
It is a bit, it's very strange, but you can't second guess the Moon Underwater. How are you, Robin? We should probably give some kind of dry Jan update.
Oh, dry Jan. Well, I'm winning and losing at the same time. There've been a couple of I've taken a couple of days break from dry Jan.
Mm.
But I still think that I'm doing dry Jan.
Yeah.
But I've really cut down. I'm not really drinking in the week, and I just want to continue that throughout the year. So kind of make the whole year into a dry Jan.
Yeah, that's perfect. And that's what everyone should be doing, really. And if dry Jan is the springboard that leads you to a little bit of moderation, then that's the point. That's the whole point in it. I'm afraid my dry January collapsed in a heap of cans, but I'm sans cans tonight.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think similarly to you, just want to up the numbers, not put too much pressure on myself. But I went to a pub last night called, I think, Harrison's.
Okay.
And that was very nice. Lovely selection of various keg beers and a superb pint of Landlord.
Mm.
Though they did have that, I mean, you know, it's not their fault because it was a Sunday, but we walked in and it was about a third full, but every table was reserved.
Yeah.
Because everyone obviously wants to get in there. Sunday roast.
Yeah. We met on Friday and went to a couple of pubs in Stockwell, which was nice. Didn't really know that area. Really liked The Surprise. That was a great pub.
Oh, yes. The Surprise was a lovely pub.
And the Priory Arms was lovely. And then I went on to a gig. You went home because we couldn't find anywhere to have a curry.
Yeah.
So you went home. And I went to see a gig, my good friend Ed Dowie. And he played at the Cavendish Arms. And that place is amazing. It's like you stepped into like the Black Lodge from Twin Peaks or something.
Ooh. So is it sort of a pub with a venue room in the back?
Yeah. But the pub itself is like, it's kind of all sofas and kind of exotic materials draped down. Really nice beer. And then the back room is like a really good gig venue with kind of black and white checkered floor, red curtains. It's all a bit of a blur, to be honest, but it was a great gig and really, yeah, what a great pub. Would recommend.
The Surprise was really nice because it was, I think it's a Young's pub, but it had a real genuine set of locals in there and it felt, and they were really nice. And one of them chatted to us, just felt like so rare that you sort of stumble in on a group of sort of eight people all in a huddle.
And there are caricatures of them. In the pub as well. It was really nice. But in the Priory Arms, I went there. They had the Camera Good Beer Guide. I think it was the 2021. And both those pubs were in it. And I had a little flick through Oxford as well, which, as you do. And Bristol, of course. It was a lovely little voyage down the stream of memory.
But Robin, low lies the mist this evening.
Yes, we.
Mist around our anculates. I heard you sighing away.
Yeah, I sighed.
You sighed for the mist mail. If anyone does want to get in touch with us here at the Moon Underwater, send your mist to john@moonunderpod.com. But Robin, what mist has settled for us this eve?
Thanks, John. Had a very nice mist in from Joe, and he refers to the fact we've mentioned the Beach Boys a couple of times recently. Hi, chap. I thought that said chaos again. Hi, chaos. Your chat about the double nomination of Pet Sounds and general excellence of the Beach Boys got me thinking about an unusual track of theirs I used to listen to quite a bit a fair few years ago called Their Hearts Were Full of Spring. There are some live versions on YouTube, but this recording is the best quality I can find of this rare gem. As an ex-a cappella singer myself, I loved and appreciated revisiting the musicality of this group and their unique voices. And those lyrics, struth, mine eyes doth weep ever so. All the best and keep up the good chat. Now that is, it's a great email, a great mist to receive, because that, I think we are both extremely fond of that song, are we not? Their Hearts Were Full of Spring.
I don't think I've heard it.
Really? Oh, it was like, well, when I was at uni, our friend Mike gave me a tape. So this is kind of slightly kind of pre-internet, and it was all the Smile sessions and Smiley Smile and all this, and it was just a blank cassette, so no song titles, didn't know what anything was, and all the songs blurred together. So I used to listen to it so much in my first year at uni, and on that was this song Their Hearts Were Full of Spring, which was a cover actually the Beach Boys did, but it's so beautiful, it's incredible what they can do with just their voices. And there's something quite magic on the, about the fact it was just on this cassette, and I had no idea like, kind of what the song was and stuff, you know. But yeah, no, that song's a very, very important song to me. So thanks for getting in touch about that, Joe.
Lovely.
Lovely. Another mist here, which is from Mike. And now this is a good mist. Okay. Because we'll have things to say about this. Don't you worry. Dear Landlord John and Robin, in all your wistful musings on the pubs of Oxford, I have never heard you mention the Gardener's Arms. I can't imagine that it has evaded your notice. After all, it's a pub and it's in Oxford. These facts alone must surely mean you are at the very least aware of its existence. Having spent some happy hours there myself, I would love to hear your thoughts and feelings on this establishment, should the nature and depth of your acquaintance with it allow. It may also be of interest to John that the food they serve is not only the suitably simple fare that befits a pub environment, but is also fully vegetarian and often vegan. As a long-term veggie myself, this gives the Gardener's Arms several extra desire points. Many happy Vespers to you both. Mike, P.S. They also play some excellent music. Now, right, first point here, Mike.
Yes, I know where this is going.
Is there are two Gardener's Arms in very close proximity.
Yes.
But because of what you say about the menu, I'm guessing you mean the Plantation Road one, not the North Parade one.
Not the North Parade one.
But yes, I like them both. But the Plantation Road one is pretty darn magique.
Well, they're both magique in their own way. I have mixed memories of the one on North Parade because they used to have these sort of mad heaters on that were way, way too hot.
I liked that one because it was like stepping back in time. I really liked it. But yes, heaters.
Yeah, the heaters were too hot, but they did have big pint glasses of monkey nuts, didn't they?
That's the bookbinders of the monkey nuts,
no,
isn't it?
No. Bookbinders has big barrels of monkey nuts, but
okay,
the Gardener's
okay.
Arms served them in pints.
Oh, right. Nice, nice. No, wait. You're thinking of the Rose and Crown, which serves pistachios in pint glasses.
No, I'm thinking of the Gardener's Arms.
This has become the most niche thing ever, talking about what nuts.
Hang on.
I think Rose and Crown, definitely pistachio.
Is the Rose and Crown on the right and the Gardener's Arms on the left?
Well, which way are you facing?
North.
I don't know that.
Hang on, let me look it up in my mind.
Rose and Crown is one of the lovely flower baskets. Gardener's Arms is the one that's kind of green. I associate it with being green.
Okay, I've got confused in my own mind.
Yeah.
The heaters and the pints of monkey nuts is...
pistachios.
Is the Rose and Crown.
Excellent pub.
Yes.
Gardener's Arms is the one where you raised a fuss because you had a lime cordial that cost £2 or something.
I did not raise a fuss. Sam raised a fuss.
Okay, yeah.
Our friend Sam. So we're both... memory and desire have mixed.
I always like the Gardener's Arms because it said, like, it was, you know, they have that little licensee information.
Yeah.
It was licensed to DJ Rhymes.
Oh, yes, it was. Yeah, DJ Rhymes, who was sort of obviously in his 70s, but sounded like he worked in Ibiza.
And that was where, do you remember our friend Merrin? We went to eat there. And she said, on the menu is egg mayonnaise.
No, it was bacon and egg mayonnaise sandwich.
Bacon and egg mayonnaise sandwich, right. And she said, is that egg mayonnaise or is it egg mayonnaise?
No, she she said,
okay,
is that bacon and egg mayonnaise or bacon and egg mayonnaise? And
yeah.
The waitress thought she'd gone completely insane.
Because all mayonnaise is made of egg. Oh, no, so is it bacon, egg, comma, mayonnaise? Or is it bacon and egg mayonnaise?
Yeah, she wanted to know whether the bacon and the egg had been mixed up with the mayo or whether it was rashers of bacon with egg mayonnaise.
I just often find myself saying that to myself. Is that egg mayonnaise or egg mayonnaise?
Yeah, yeah. No, it was the relationship with the bacon that was a question. But Mike, in answer to your wonderful mist, we love the Gardner's Arms on Plantation Road because they used to sell pint and a half glasses of ale.
They did sell pint and a half glasses of ale. And I just remember falling in love with pubs when I went to that pub.
Yeah.
At uni. Because I think I went out with you, it was like a Saturday afternoon, we were with our friend Mike. And it was that glorious time around, like, you know, when the football results come in, they had it on the telly and it's just they were playing the results, had scampi fries. Remember, I can almost touch it.
And the best thing about the pint and a half glasses, which sound much better than they are in terms of the reality, because you think it's the best thing ever invented.
Yeah.
And then the sort of the last few mouthfuls are a bit sort of warm and flat. However, every time you're served one, you get to say, it comes in pints, just like in Lord of the Rings, because you look like a hobbit when you're holding them.
But ironically, it's not a pint. So.
No, it's not. It comes in 1.5 pints. So thank you very much for those wonderful mists that led Robin and I into a pretty rigorous self-evaluation there.
Yeah. There was a lot of kind of correcting of kind of misinformation there, often to do with food stuffs.
It felt a bit like time present and time past were both present in time future or something along those lines.
Yeah.
But it's time to sweep aside all thought of the Gardener's Arms, be it North Parade or Plantation Road, and prepare the Moon Underwater for this week's guest. Robin, have you seen the light outside?
Yeah, it's very, very dark light.
Yes, it's sort of like a reverse sunset in, well, I want to say black and white. There's hints of blue in there, but it just looks absolutely stunning.
Really beautiful. A rainbow of shadows.
A rainbow of shadows. That's a very good way of putting it. And I think what that rainbow of shadows is trying to tell us, that one of TV's most colourful food experts, one of TV's most watchable bon vivers, is on his way to bring a bit of brightness to the Moon Underwater. And here he is, reflected numerous times in the glass outside, opening the door. It's Oliver Payton. Hello, Oliver.
Hello, hello, hello. How are you?
Welcome to the Moon Underwater. Pull up a pew. What's your favourite type of pub chair to sit in?
Oh, I love a booth.
Oh, well, the booth is yours. It will arrange itself towards us. I have to start by saying, if you took all of my TV viewing over the past 10 years, you would probably feature highest in terms of the time I've spent watching any one individual person.
That is very sad.
But I'm such a huge fan of Great British Menu. From series one, it seemed to solve every problem that other cookery programs, especially competitive ones, had, in that the food was hot, the food was of a very, very high standard, and they were all sort of judged to the same standard, and you got the access to the chefs in the kitchen, you got the separation of the judges. So, I mean, there's no question attached to this. I just want to say it's a huge pleasure to talk to you because you've played such a big part in my TV watching over the years.
Thank you. Thank you.
I did have one slightly geeky question about it, though.
That's all right.
Now, I've never been to a Michelin-starred restaurant. I've had nice meals, but I don't think I've ever been to what I would class as fine dining.
You're a pub guy.
I'm a pub guy. I know what I like. I like Chinese. I like Indian food, and I do like to eat in nice places. But I've never, you know, been to a proper like tasting menu or anything like that.
You need to go to A Wong.
Oh, I'm obsessed with going to A Wong. Is it amazing?
Yeah, it's amazing. He's great.
But my question is, when you get a dish on GBM and you sort of all say, oh, this hasn't worked, and you all have your own way of expressing sort of disappointment, you will sort of move away from your dish. It's that way that you know you don't like it, because it's almost like you want someone to take it away because it's upset you so.
The problem is that my mum used to say, if you haven't got anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. So
yeah.
when I'm moving away, I'm trying to find the politest way not to offend my mother, God rest her soul, because sometimes you just think, how did this person get on here? Because, you know, they were in the wrong universe.
I think there's also some good body language with the spectacles of Matthew Fort and when Andy Oliver was a judge. Depending on where the spectacles were on the head, it often kind of gave you a signal as to how much they'd enjoyed it. Sometimes both specs were on the head, sometimes there were both specs were on the nose, you know.
I think what's interesting about GBM was when it started, we all just thought it was going to be one series, and it was people like Anthony Worrell Thompson and known TV chefs at the time. And we didn't really think it was going to go beyond one series. And certainly Prue and Matthew and I, we were in a basement in Fleet Street it was the old Express building, I think, and there was no power to it. So the choice was either to have cameras or to have heating. And it was winter. And so when the cameras would go off, we would all just run for our coats because it was so cold, because it wasn't like a proper studio. And, you know, and it's really, you know, it's quite interesting to see how the show has evolved, because at the time there really wasn't a massive British food culture, mainly because, and this is my belief, is it was, you know, food was very London-centric and our major conurbation-centric. And then what happened was, you know, GBM came along. We made the rules stricter and stricter. Farmers who don't get out very much started watching the show. They could see people producing food, producing things, and there was a demand for these ingredients. So they started getting interested in producing ingredients. People started then, chefs thought, well, actually, maybe I could do something outside London. Because any great restaurant in the world that I've ever been to only uses its local producers. And there wasn't, we just didn't have that whole sort of dynamic going on. And so now, I mean, you know, there's so many great restaurants. The best restaurants are mostly outside London, mainly because the good chefs have access to produce. And so that whole thing happened. And it's really, if you think about it, really, it's only 15, 16 years from the time of, say, Anthony Worrell Thompson to now. And you look at that food evolution, I mean, it's really quite incredible. I don't think any country in the world, you know, could have done what's happened. So, you know, there's so much. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. Sometimes you just get blown away. I mean, when you have a great dish, you know a great dish when you have one. You know, because I'll stop waffling on about Great British Menu in a minute, but, you know, we can tell where chefs have worked because there'll be little traits in the dishes. So we know that the chef will have worked in some restaurant beforehand or where he'd come through. But when you have a dish that's produced by a chef where you can't see where the chef has come from, that's when the food's really interesting. Because you think, oh, that's new. So that's where I think the show gets very exciting.
Well, I wanted to ask you about Michael O'Hare's dish, Emancipation, because honestly, I mean, this again, you're going to think I'm such a saddo. When that dish came out, your response to it, I actually had tears in my eyes. It was the black china hand coming off the canvas.
I know the dish. I can't remember my response to it, though.
But I mean, it was tens across the board. Was that one of the ones where you were just like, oh my God, this is next level stuff.
Oh yeah. I mean, because Michael is, you know, he's an individual. He is like, he is a mixture of Ozzy Osbourne, Johnny Rotten and Johnny Cash. You know, he's got a, he's got a lot of genres going on there, you know. Michael's amazing because, you know, I think part of the problem, Michael's an interesting point, is it's actually hard to do anything very different because people don't really want different. Different doesn't sell. What sells is, you know, what sells is safety, you know. So to be financially safe, you've got to have your sea bass dishes and you've got to have your whatever they are, you know, your steak and your blah. And it's there's people come in and they might go to come into a menu and they go, ooh, sea urchin. But they don't order it. You know what I mean? It's like they just think, ooh, I'm in a restaurant that's got sea urchin. You know, it's.
So when you have one of those dishes where you all think it doesn't work, my original geeky question was to the untrained palate like me. Would I still be blown away by that dish, or would I know that something had gone wrong? How bad are the bad ones? Because the chefs are very talented.
Yeah, so the problem you have is it's multi-layered, because what you have, if you have chefs that work for a company, they will have been prepped, they'd have been given time to prepare their dishes a long time in advance, and they would have practiced. If you're an individual chef who has closed his restaurant on a Sunday after Sunday service and on Monday morning comes along to the studio, it's quite a lot. It's a much bigger challenge because most people who have just one restaurant are, you know, they're there, they're on the stoves, they're running the business, and they are, you know, they're on the front line. So they don't have a lot of time to practice. So, you know, it's a bit like being chucked in the Coliseum in a way. So unless they've had that opportunity to prepare, I mean, when chefs come back a second or third time, they have more knowledge of what they need to do. So that's why they tend to do better on a second or third round if they're individual chefs. So a lot of the time that they blow a dish, in answer to your original question, is because they just weren't ready, you know. And so they'll overcook something, or they'll miss an ingredient, or they'll be too nervous because, you know, there's a lot of cameras in the kitchen. You know, you come in and there are seven or eight cameras staring at you, and you're thinking, WTF.
The link to the brief is always the hardest one. Yeah, well, that's the thing I'm always screaming at the telly, is like, there's no link to the brief. You know, that's the thing that surely is the thing you want to hammer home. But sometimes it's not kind of clear when people are doing it.
When a chef comes along and he just, you know, uses one of his or her restaurant dishes, and yeah, they just put it on a plate and they put a red nose on it, or they put it on a dodgy LP they bought in the local record store. You know what I mean? It's like, you just think, I mean, all right. But I think sometimes the brief is quite hard. You know, trying to make it really creative is quite hard. But, you know, I mean, to me, you know, great food is simple food. So when chefs have tons of ingredients on a plate, it makes it 10 times harder for it to work as a dish. The most successful dishes are generally the ones with the least amount of ingredients. And in order to get to the least amount of ingredients, it takes an awful lot of practice, if you know what I mean.
I was quite impressed with that guy a while ago who did one. I think it was about children's literature, and he made a dish based around Lord of the Flies, which is, I'm not sure you want that at a banquet. Yeah. You know, a dish about man's inhumanity to man.
Yeah. No, but all of that. I mean, when you look at stuff like literature, you can really do a lot with, can't you? You know what I mean? So it's and also some of the guest judges on that were just, you know, sometimes the judges when they come on, you think, oh my God! I mean, Andrew Ridgeley. Oh my God, Andrew Ridgeley. I mean, he blew us away with the amount of knowledge he had about food. I mean, he was unbelievable about food.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you know, he has a sort
That's
of
so funny.
Yeah, and he's got his own little pin for his tie for one of those things for lunch. I mean, he's like a proper food, you know. And every restaurant you'd ever been to, he's, you know, we started having little sort of, oh, well, have you been to Blah in Lima? And he's going, yeah, but I didn't really like that. I liked the Blah. And I'm going, fuck, I didn't go to that one. <You know?
laughs> So to move on from the restaurant to the bar, before you were sort of came to prominence on Great British Menu, you were a very successful restaurateur. And I wondered, what part does alcohol play in the planning of a new restaurant and in its successful execution? Because it struck me, thinking about speaking to you, that the wine list or the drinks list is actually the first thing you see in a restaurant. It's the first thing you peruse. So I wonder if you could just sort of talk about the role that alcohol or drinks in general play.
My backstory is I used to import alcohol. So I used to import Absolut vodka, and I used to import Sapporo beer and things like that back in the 80s. So my, I used to have a microbrewery called Mesh. I'd one in Manchester, I'd one in London. You know, I started brewing beer because, you know, you go into a pub and all you could see is foreign beers brewed under license in the UK. And they were, I mean, to me, you were just buying the badge because, I mean, and mostly I'd spend most of my time in the loo because they were so low alcohol by volume and they were like, they were just rubbish. So what I tried to do is to set up a bar where you could have cocktails, microbrewed beers, everything all in one place with the wine list, which is, again, if you wanted a good beer, you had to go to a camera pub at the time, and then pubs didn't serve cocktails and they didn't have good wine. So again, the culture of going out has changed dramatically. I mean, I had a restaurant in St. James's Park, and when I started it, Prue had one before me, and they wouldn't let Prue sell alcohol to take away. I was the first restaurant in a Royal Park where you could buy alcohol to take away. So it means you could come into the restaurant, you could buy alcohol, you could go and sit in the park. I mean, it sounds a bit weird now, but you know, I mean, when I opened the Atlantic Bar and Grill, it was the first restaurant in London, first venue in London, where you didn't have to, we had a 3 a.m. license, but it was the first venue where you didn't have to pay in after 11 o'clock. Because previously, if you wanted a drink after 11 o'clock, you had to pay in. So I've always sort of tried to pride myself on pushing the boundaries about how people feel about booze. And I mean, to me, when I was in my first restaurant, when we were creating a wine list, I mean, it was super important to me that people really were able to understand what wine was. I mean, because what you don't want to do is have some snotty sommelier looking down at you like as if you didn't know what you were doing. So, and also trying to make things, you know, the psychology in a wine list is large. You know what I mean? It takes a lot to make a great wine list. I mean, you go into many of these sort of posh restaurants, in my opinion, you look at the wine list and you think, I'm not paying that, you know, because it's just, they have so many wines. A lot of them are the wrong vintages, or they're just, you can't get anything under 100 quid a bottle that's going to taste decent. Some of them don't even start at 75 quid. So I think for many restaurateurs, the psychology of the wine list now is really important. So, and also I think the mark of a good venue, I don't think necessarily restaurant, I hate to keep saying the word restaurant. I mean, if I go to a pub, then I look at the wine list first, because I have a sort of expectation that any pub I would go to, I would expect the beer to be decent, because I wouldn't be going there otherwise, if you know what I mean.
I went to, there's a Hakkasan in London, and the first time I went, I really enjoyed it. The next time I went, it was like I was in a nightclub. It was very strange. It was sort of all sort of UV light. But anyway, the wine list I found, it was so much stuff. And part of you is going, oh my God, look at all this amazing stuff. But then the other part of you goes, I have no idea what my inn is here. I mean, there's probably 80 wines. So do you think it's important to have like a load of great wines, or a sort of a slightly smaller selection that perhaps people feel they could have explained to them by a sommelier or a waiter?
I mean, Hakkasan caters to a particular market, if you know what I mean. It's not somewhere where, you know, there's one in Vegas, they're in Ibiza, you know, it's a bit like buying a sort of a fancy handbag, if you know what I mean, because they're trying to make it into a sort of global brand. I mean, it's a very, very expensive setup. I mean, personally, I like smaller lists. Again, it's a bit like food. The smaller the list, the more work you have to do to make it good. And anything where you're over 80 to 100 wines, you're in the wine management business, not in the wine list business. I think 50 to 60 wines will cover most regions in the world and most decent price points, I would say. But I do love perusing a wine list. It tells you a lot about a restaurant. It's one of the great indicators of how it's run. And also, here's my little...
Really?
yeah, absolutely. Because it takes constant love and attention. It's like having a baby, because vintages change, stuff changes all the time. And if you've got nice wine, that wine runs out. And then you have to either change vintage or get something similar. You know, yeah, it's a moving feast all the time, if you know what I mean. The key to going to and ordering wine, though, is there is always on any wine list. You're getting some of my secrets out of me now. There's always a hidden gem that the sommelier or the manager has put on the list. There's always a gem.
The one that they want.
The one that they've picked because they really like it. It's not too expensive. It's somewhere in the middle, and it's always there. It's the little hidden. It's the hidden thing. So you always have to ask for that.
Oh, that's a great tip. Thank you so much. Well, moving on to your dream pub, what are you seeing before you? Because you must be someone who has seen so many interiors of bars and pubs and restaurants. But when you walk into your ideal pub, what you walk through that door, what sort of setup is it? What sort of vibe?
So as an Irish person, one of the things that upsets me greatly about London is how cliquey it is. So... again, I'm just going to refer back to the Atlantic, because I used to go to the Groucho Club. And one of the reasons I set up the Atlantic was I used to go to the Groucho Club every night, have an extremely good time. But my circle of friends was very narrow because it was the same people all the time. And when I set up the Atlantic, I wanted to make sure that it was lots of different people all the time. Any pub or any place I want to go into, I don't want to see loads of people with beards or loads of workers. I just want to see lots of different people. A pub is about community. And, you know, I think pubs should have lots of different people in them. They shouldn't be intimidating to anybody. You know, everybody should be able to come. London is the most amazing city in the world. I want to see lots of amazing people. So
you want sort of all humanity is here kind of vibe?
100%.
Well, that's such a great ethos to take into creating a dream pub, that its clientele are as varied as the drinks it provides.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Dave Berry, and I am fascinated by my next-door neighbour. His name is Neil Srinivasan, and he's a leading cardiologist. Since I moved to this particular part of London, Neil and I have started to become friends. Our polite greetings over the fence turned into garden barbecues and drinks down the local pub. But with unfettered access to someone with a job that is so far removed from my own, I'm desperate to find out more about his industry, one that is quite literally a matter of life and death. In Doctor Next Door, I'll be doing my utmost to learn all about Neil as a medical professional, but also Neil as a person, because, believe it or not, even doctors have lives outside of the operating theatre. But this podcast isn't just here to feed my own curiosities. I want you to be involved in these conversations too. I can't wait to get into this, so make sure you subscribe or follow Doctor Next Door from wherever you usually get your podcasts.
So to start off in this pub of all comers, what would be your first two draft selections?
Draft beer.
Well, it could be anything that's available on draft. I mean, I'm guessing you're not going to choose an Echo Falls Zinfandel on draft.
No. I have to say, Alistair Hook, who set up Meantime, set up my microbrewery for me. So he was my brewer in Mash, and I had.
Is he known as Big Al? Is his nickname Big Al?
I don't think so. He doesn't strike me as a Big Al. He's quite a robust chap, but I don't. I think he probably he's. I don't think he's Big Al. No.
Okay, my friend went on a brewery tour of the Meantime Brewery and just said it was run by a guy called Big Al, who was very, very charismatic and quite a funny tour guide.
No, I don't think Alistair would have, I don't think Alistair would have been doing that. So, I had one again recently, and I was in Riverside Studios, actually, and it was really good. And I think, that the pale ale has remained quite consistent. The other thing I'm a very big fan of is... begins with the P, Brown Label, Borough, Maiden Borough. They use those craft labels on the bottles.
Oh, not Kernel, not the Kernel.
Pint of Kernel, yes. The draft Kernel is actually very, very nice.
Yeah, it's lovely. Mm.
So is that their porter or their table beer, or what would that be their pale ale?
It's their pale ale. So the story of pale ale to me, by the way, is it's lager, to me. Because one of the things I'd done when we started in Mash was we started with a pale ale, and there was no pale ale in the UK other than Sierra Nevada. And you could see quite a few. We used to go to all those sort of trade shows in America, in Denver, Colorado, and all those sort of, weird places where you'd see lots of small microbreweries. And one of the reasons that we sort of brought pale ale here and with Alistair was I just wanted something, you can get a lot of character out of pale ale because it's got less bubbles in it. And, I think making a good pale ale is one of the keys of good brewing, if you know what I mean, because it can be a very beautiful thing. I also think there are so many crap canned beers around at the moment that it is just, I think they spent all the money on the artwork for the label. They took a tab of acid, got a graphic designer, and then said, no, turn it up to 11, and then forgot about brewing the beer, because I find them all, brewing beer is a great skill, we don't have many brewers in the UK. We have lots of people who think they're brewers, but very few of them are really good, if you know what I mean. That's just my opinion.
I do think a lot of those... I know exactly the craft beers you mean. The problem with a lot of them is they seem to be so strong. It seems to be not much of a market for the lower percentage ones. When you're looking at 9-10% beers, yeah, it's very challenging.
Yeah, it's really and you got to be careful because you got to really look as well, because otherwise, a couple of those 9% beers and you before you go out and you think whoops.
Yeah.
So in your dream pub we've got two pale ales, we've got Meantime and Kernel.
Yeah,
nice. Well, when you go to top end restaurants, I'm guessing they don't have a big beer selection. That's sort of because they're not going to make a huge amount of money of someone having sort of one or two bottles of beer with a meal. It's all frowned upon to ask for a pint in a top restaurant.
I think, the reason, I always say I can smell a good restaurant before I've even had a menu, but which I think you can. But if you go into a place and they haven't got good choices, whatever the choices are, whether it's beer, wine, spirits, whatever it is, you can tell what people are interested in. So I wouldn't like any restaurant that didn't have a good selection of beer, because I just don't think that's right. I remember once when I was young, I took the girl I was going out at the time, I'm not going to name the restaurant, to a very fancy restaurant for Saturday lunch with her father. Her father had invited us, and she wanted ice cream to start, and the restaurant wouldn't serve ice cream to start. And we just couldn't work out why they wouldn't do that, because we're going, it's on the menu. Serve the ice cream, it's like they just wouldn't do it. And I just, things like that, when people just think people just want champagne or wine, I mean, it's ludicrous, because restaurants and bars, I think much more so, I think pubs are far more interesting than restaurants, by the way, because I think pubs are, pubs have to reinvent themselves as a genre, as a thing, to be successful. And I think we will see, a massive change in pubs soon because most of them can't stay the way they are. It's not a sustainable model to keep doing what they're doing. Yeah, so I just wouldn't go to a place again. I wouldn't return to a place again where I didn't feel, for example, that they didn't have good beer. You know what I mean? I think you expect it.
What do you think it is that's unsustainable at the minute? And is it something that COVID has sort of sped up?
Yeah, I think it is. I think COVID has, you know, re-entrenched people's views about the burbs, how they live their lives, how much time they're spending schlepping in and out on a train that is delayed because the snow is too heavy or the leaves are fallen on the tracks or whatever the things are. And I think people's quality of life has become much more important. And the way one is, this certainly people are using their time. You notice in the suburbs and country pubs are far busier now. And if you speak to any of the people running them, they are a lot busier simply because people aren't moving around so much. And also they've, you know, a sense of community has come out of that anyway, hasn't it, in terms of just people sticking together more. So I think it's a big opportunity for pubs at the moment.
Well, I think also, so the last time pubs were this threatened was by the recession, the financial crisis. And I think that in a similar way to COVID, though an awful lot of great pubs will close, an awful lot of bad ones will too, because people are much more choosy about where they spend their time and their money.
I think, look, it's been a shit show in terms of, can I say that?
Yeah,
because I think, you know, everybody was expecting the Christmas trade this year to save a lot of people's asses. And because people have been through a horrific time and they're hoping the Christmas trade and those bookings and people's desire to go out, because, you know, it was pretty hard to get a reservation anywhere in the run up to Christmas because people were so excited to get back out there again. And then when it fell off the face of the earth, you know, most restaurants make 50% of their profit. When I'm saying restaurants, I mean pubs as well, by the way. I don't know what I'd describe. You make 50% of their profit in December in the run-up to Christmas. And they use that profit to sustain themselves through the January and February period until spring comes again and people start going out again. And, you know, I feel really sorry for people who've got good businesses, basically, who, you know, but good people always come back, you know. So, and I always tell that to anybody who's worked for me before or anybody I know, I say, you know, good people always rise again. Do you know what I mean? And I think good pubs, I mean, yeah, I think most of the people that I know in pubs will get through it because they're good at what they do. Some of them won't, and some of them will come back again. But I feel really sad for, you know, I mean, it's just... Hospitality is just, I know it's a bit boring to talk about it, but, you know, between COVID and then when they were able to trade, the staff couldn't come in because they got COVID. So I know lots of people who just couldn't open their doors even to take the trade.
I went to the pub and I had a drink with my friend. It was really nice. The pub was called The Moon Underwater.
So moving on to your next choice, Oliver, you've got two bottles or cans. Given your vast experience of wine, I'm guessing we're going to see some wine here, but we're going to get to see Oliver Payton's hidden gems.
Mm.
Northern Italy, there's two. My favourite wines are from Northern Italy because I think Northern Italy and Rhone, mainly because I think Northern Italy is a much underappreciated region. So you tend to get better value there. And plus there are higher altitude wines, and I quite like slightly higher altitude wines. And I like Rhone because Rhone is probably the region where you still got loads of nutcases producing wine. I mean, that's not completely true, but I quite like the variety of wine that comes out of Rhone. You know, part of the problem with French wine is in general is their job is to, the Appellation's job is to keep the wine the same in their Appellation so that people recognize it as their wine. Whereas in Rhone, there are still some people out there, you know, messing with the system, in my opinion. But also, I just like that type of wine. I'm not I'm not overly obsessed with older wines. So, you know, if someone offers me a great expensive Bordeaux, I'm never going to turn it down. But it's not a go-to wine for me. I like wines that you don't have to spend a lot of money on wine. I think it's sort of, if you go to a restaurant and you know what you're doing, you know, you're going to get a pretty good bottle of wine under 50 quid, I would say, if you know what you're doing. It's harder and harder to get a good bottle of wine under 50 quid, but it can be done. I'm always looking for the good value region, because places where the wines haven't been ramped up yet, like the Italians have started to ramp up their prices. They're starting to follow the French with more Appellation and controlling the regions. But, you know, Eastern Europe's producing some great wines, so you can get really good white wines coming out of Eastern Europe. Germany's got great wines. Austria's got great wines. Greeks have started to make good wine. So I would always be looking. I mean, here's another little tip. So on a wine list, the biggest margins are on house wines, obviously, wines by the glass, and known wines. So Chablis, Sancerre, Pinot Grigio, because the general view of the operator would be people who order those wines are not particularly interested in wine.
Are we edging towards my personal favourite, our old friend, the Riesling?
Oh, we love an old Riesling, don't we? Also, you know, the other funny thing about Rieslings, Rieslings still remain quite good value on wine lists because you know, they become more popular now, but there's still a lot of value to be had in a Riesling.
But I do think people expect, if they order it, to someone to come out with a sort of a 2-litre bottle of hock that your gran might have sort of swigged from at Christmas. So do you have a specific example of the Northern Italian or Rhone wine that you would have in your dream pub, a particular grape or...?
Well, Cornas red wine is... I love Cornas. It's just my type of wine. It's got a little bit of edge to it, but there's a deep sense of quality to it. Condriot white wine, which you drink very young. I love Condriot. Really good summer drinking wine. And then there's a wine called Terlaner in northern Italy, which I love Terlaner. And also the Veneto is making some nice wines. So all of that the corner north of Venice, all the way up there. Really lovely wines. Trentino, Alto Adige, Veneto.
So is Cornas a red wine and Condriot a white wine?
Indeed.
So we'll go for those as your two, because I do have to keep you to two, I'm afraid, in this dream scenario. But a Cornas and a Condriot sound very, very nice. Well, before we end part one, we head over to Robin Allender, who's going to set this week's Moon Underwater pub quiz.
Okay, everybody, pens out, eyes down. It's time for the quiz. He played for Zimbabwe, but he was born in South Africa. I know Alaska is bigger. That wasn't the question. Put your phone away. Right, Michael Jackson's Funky Monkey has been deducted 5 points.
Thank you, John. Yes, this week's pub quiz. As ever, I'm going to read three questions and then we'll give our Moon Underwater regulars and guests an opportunity to ruminate, and then in part two we'll go through the answers and see how well we all did. So this week the quiz is about identifying the famous chef from a quotation that I will give you. So I'm going to read out a quote, which could be from a book or a TV show, and you have to tell me which chef said it. Do you think I need to do, should I try doing impressions as well, or just kind of keep it fairly...
It's always welcome to have a quiz master who's willing to go the extra yard.
Okay. But
has it got an expletive in it?
No, there are no expletives. So no Ramsay.
But Oliver, don't feel you need to know straight away, because we'll do the answers after the break. So don't feel the pressure's on too much.
Yeah, there's no pressure. So quotation one. There are people who claim to be instinctive cooks who never follow recipes or weigh anything at all. All I can say is they're not very fussy about what they eat. For me, cooking is an exact art and not some casual game. So that's the first. That's not a very good impression. That's a terrible impression, actually.
I was going to say, is that an impression?
Yeah, it just sounds like me. Yeah, but she's basically, I'll give them a clue. For me, cooking is an exact art and not some casual game. Question two, quotation two. Now you mustn't be frightened of mayonnaise. Sounds quite similar to the first impression. Now you mustn't be frightened of mayonnaise. Okay, quotation three. I can only think of one or two things that are sexier in the mouth than crisp, flaky pastry and hot, flowing cheese. And one of those is an oyster. It's very rude. So that was three sexy things in the mouth. Two was mayonnaise, and one was about cooking being an exact art and not a casual game. So there we go.
Well, on those culinary tenterhooks, we will leave you folks before. You can take a little break in between the episodes to recharge your glass, pop to the loo, or get your favourite snack. We'll rejoin Oliver Payton very soon.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.